Funding for this podcast comes from MathWorks, creators of MATLAB and Simulink software, accelerating the pace of engineering and science. Learn more at MathWorks.com.
From WBUR Boston and WRNI Providence, I'm Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. Last Friday, on the streets of Moscow, the American editor of Forbes magazine's Russian edition, Paul Klebnikov, was struck with four bullets to the chest and died. Klebnikov is at least the 15th journalist killed in Russia and the first American journalist killed since President Vladimir Putin came into office. What may have done him in? In May, Paul Klebnikov published a list of the 100 wealthiest people in Russia. And Russian money does not like attention. Moscow, he said, has more billionaires than any other city in the world, and maybe more danger around its money and power than any other city as well. Distant Chechnya gets the headlines with 42 dead there just today. But the death of Paul Klebnikov, son of Russian Americans who dreamed of rebirth for his family's post-communist old country, is a harsh reminder of the dark struggles at the heart of Russia for wealth, for power, for the future. Tonight on Point, the death of an American journalist and the lethal intersection of business, politics, and crime in Vladimir Putin's Russia. We begin in Moscow, where Andrew Jack, Moscow bureau chief for the Financial Times, has been covering the murder of Paul Klebnikov. I asked him to describe the reaction in Russia to the American editor's death.
Well, first of all, obviously, widespread shock, not only from the foreign community, but many Russian journalists and politicians, and very widespread coverage in the Russian media. But above all, perhaps surprise to a Westerner, somebody quite a high profile, working obviously for a very well-known magazine, though only recently launched in Russia, sucked into something so rising and bloody.
14 journalists killed in Russia since 2000, we're told, but this is the first foreign or Western journalist. Is that right?
That's right, and indeed, not just in the journalistic community, but generally, the killing of Klebnikov breaks a taboo because it's extremely rare that any Westerner, businessman, expat of some other sort, person based locally, let alone journalist, has been drawn into this fairly small number of high-profile contract killings do take place in Russia from time.
Paul Klebnikov said in May that he believed the era of so-called bandit capitalism is already in the past in Russia. Do you think that his killing, Andrew Jack, is evidence that is not quite true?
Well, there clearly are high-profile murders and even contract killings and settlings of scores that take place in many countries around the world, not only in Russia. Russia certainly is an exception. I think in comparison with the early 1990s, when Russia really was in a very wild capitalist and anarchic stage, and there was a lot more settling of scores by violence, that's an era that certainly has passed by. But clearly, by breaching this taboo on attacking a Westerner, and by suggesting perhaps a motive that goes beyond purely the commercial, it does suggest that we're certainly far from living here in a civilized country.
As Paul Klebnikov lay dying on the sidewalk in Moscow, he reportedly said to another magazine editor, Alexander Gordeev, that he did not know who might have wanted him dead. What's the speculation in these early days after his murder?
Well, there's all sorts of speculation, but above all, mystery and confusion. Even in instances in the past where, for example, there's been a commercial dispute involving a clash perhaps between a Russian and a Western company, it's normally been a high-profile Russian rather than the Westerner behind or in the most senior position who's been targeted for any violence. One possibility is that this was part of a sort of commercial dispute. Forbes, obviously a very well-known international publication, coming into a market of advertising, which actually is booming in Russia and which has been associated with violent settlings of scores in the past. The second possible theory is that the killing was in some way related either to Paul Klebnikov's own writings or more generally those of the Forbes magazine that he was representing, which only recently had published a quite groundbreaking list of Russia's richest people, many of whom made their fortunes, very considerable fortunes, in a very short period of time during the 1990s, and some of whom may not have been too happy to be put into the spotlight in such a prominent media publication.
This was the list of the 100 wealthiest Russians, including lots of billionaires in Moscow. Those lists are put together in many countries. The journalists who compile them don't typically get shot. Why is that such a sensitive subject in Russia?
Well, particularly over the last few months, with the clampdown on a number of the so-called oligarchs, these very tightly politically connected businessmen, and notably in Russia, the case of Mikhail Khodorkovsky, the head of this Russian oil company, Yukos, who's currently sitting in jail, there's definitely been a sense that their time has come and gone, and that they may be vulnerable to new attacks from the Kremlin because they are seen as something of a political challenge to the current regime of Vladimir Putin. But on the other hand, it has to be said that the security services and indeed probably most of their own commercial rivals or even potential large criminal groups would already have known, in essence, the sort of wealth and business interests that these individuals had. So it does seem a little bit strange that simply a publication in a magazine bringing those figures to a slightly wider audience would justify something as brutal as Paul Zhebnikov's murder.
The top prosecutor in Russia, Prosecutor General Vladimir Ustinov, has said that he's personally going to direct the investigation into Paul Khlebnikov's murder. And yet, as I understand, no one has been convicted in the murder of the 14 journalists that have died since the year 2000. What are the odds that anyone will be brought to trial in this case?
Well, of course, the scale of this is a little bit different, given the fact that we're talking about an American citizen working for a rich and prestigious U.S. publication, and we might perhaps see some degree of political pressure from the U.S. through Mr. Khlebnikov's own family coming down and demanding some degree of FBI supervision or even a sort of separate parallel inquiry. But it's true, unfortunately, that not only in the case of these journalists who have been killed over the past few years, but also a number of other high-level killings of politicians and businessmen have never been solved. So, unfortunately, this may remain a mystery for a very long time.
Andrew, do you feel fear among other foreign journalists in Moscow now?
I think the problem is, unless or until we ever get a slightly clearer idea of what might have really been behind this contract killing, it's difficult to judge. As I say, the fact that it has broken a taboo perhaps raises a little bit of concern. But I think in day-to-day life in Moscow, this sort of violence is not something that you factor in unless you know personally the victim. So I don't think there's a huge change in the degree of perception of fear amongst ordinary journalists at this stage.
And yet, a blow right into the heart of that foreign journalist community. Andrew, thanks so much for joining us tonight.
Thank you.
Andrew Jack is Moscow bureau chief for the Financial Times and author of the forthcoming book, Inside Putin's Russia, Can There Be Reform Without Democracy? We're talking tonight about a death in Moscow and its meaning. What was your first thought when you heard of the Forbes editor gunned down in the streets of the Russian capital? A billionaire's revenge, gangsters, the government. 15 years after it left the Soviet Union behind, what road is Russia on? You can join the conversation tonight at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. Joining me now from Paris is Serge Schmemann, editorial page editor at the International Herald Tribune and former Moscow bureau chief for the New York Times from 1990 to 1995. He was Moscow correspondent for the Times from 1980 to 1986. He's author of an essay in today's Times about Paul Khlebnikov's murder, entitled Journalist's Death Makes It Harder to Excuse Putin's Excesses. Good evening and welcome, Serge Schmemann.
Good evening.
Thanks for joining us, Serge. I know that Paul Khlebnikov was a friend of yours. Tell us about him. Who was he?
Paul Khlebnikov was indeed a friend of mine. I've known that family for many years in New York. And Paul was first and foremost a reporter, but he was also a historian. He had a doctorate from the London School of Economics, and he had written his doctoral dissertation about Stolypin. Stolypin was a reformer under Nicholas II in the last days of the Russian Empire, who had been gunned down. He was assassinated at the end, and he had tried to do some agricultural reforms, some other social reforms in Russia. And this had been a very important part of Paul's life, turning this thesis into a book. I think he very much believed that Russia had had a chance at the beginning of the last century to reform itself, and I think he very earnestly believed that there was a chance to do this now.
Born in 1963 in New York City, went to St. Bernard's School, Exeter Academy, UC Berkeley, as you say, his PhD at the London School of Economics, son of parents and grandparents from Russia. And when and why did he go back to contemporary Russia, Serge?
He had been working on Forbes magazine for quite a few years. He did quite a bit of investigative reporting in the States. But as soon as Russia started coming out of the communist era, he was fascinated by it. He very much was fascinated by that process. And he wrote quite a bit. He wrote about the oligarchs. He wrote about all that's going on there. And I think for him it was quite a dream to go back and to open a Forbes magazine in Russia. He thought he could really contribute to that process. He could become part of it. He could, in a way, be a guide for Russia to help guide Russia on its way out of the communist chaos.
Serge, your emotions and your second thoughts about what's going on in Putin's Russia poured out on the editorial page of the Times today. Share with us that outpouring.
Well, I heard about Paul's death very shortly after it happened on Friday, after it was discovered, and I must say I was furious. I have shared a lot of Paul's optimism. You know, I've done quite a few stories trying also to say that Putin may be the right thing for Russia at this moment. But there has been this steady erosion of the press, of the free press. There has been a gathering of power inside the Kremlin, and the killing of a Western reporter, which is indeed a taboo, just seemed to me, and it turns out to many people, I knew that something is going seriously wrong, which perhaps we have all been denying in our wishful thinking for Russia, that we have all thought that Russia is moving in a certain direction, and yes, there are setbacks, and yes, there are problems, but it's going in that direction. But the death of Paul, and coming after so many unsolved killings of reporters, after so many attacks and curtailing of the press, just seemed to break that illusion. It seemed to confirm that, in fact, the place was not moving very fast and it was not moving in any good direction.
So if it's not, as you write today, Serge Maimon, if Russia is not just in transition, struggling to emerge from communism's rubble, just 3 days after Paul Klebnikov's death, what is going on there?
What worries me, I suppose, most of all, is that the place is not developing a public clamor for freedom. There just does not seem to be a great indignation that reporters who have tried to point out some of the corruption, who have tried to point out some of the banditry that still goes on, that they get killed and that nothing is resolved. Some of these people were investigating apparent crimes by the state. There were quite a few murders in the city of Tulyati where people were investigating the car factory there, other industries. And I suppose that if the reporters died and there was great indignation and there was great anger, you'd think, okay, it happens. But at least the people are really beginning to wonder why. But I just have failed to hear that kind of clamor for improvement. There are quite a few chat groups I was on today in Russia where one of the very dominant sentiments is, well, these Westerners just have to stop teaching us what to do. They have to stop teaching us their ways. There's almost a resentment. I don't know how common that is. I don't read enough of those chat groups. But I suppose that was my sense, that there had really been no evidence of serious movement.
A kind of bitter disappointment at a bitter event. Paul Klebnikov leaving behind his wife, Musa, and three children. We're talking tonight about a death in Moscow. Serge Neiman, stay with us. Listeners, you can join us. After 14 dead Russian journalists and now an American, is Russia headed toward an open society or somewhere else? We're at 1-800-423-8255. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a death in Moscow, the murder of American journalist Paul Klebnikov, and the lethal intersection of business, politics, and crime that persists in Vladimir Putin's Russia. You can join our conversation tonight. What was your first thought when you heard of the Forbes editor gunned down in the streets of Moscow? A billionaire's revenge, gangsters, the government. Can you imagine why simply being publicly listed as one of Russia's richest men would be a possible reason to kill? And what is the message in the terrible four bullets that killed Paul Klebnikov? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. We're joined from a very late Paris tonight by Serge Schmemann, former Moscow bureau chief of the New York Times, now editorial page editor at the International Herald Tribune. And with me in the studio tonight, Marshall Goldman, professor emeritus of Russian economics at Wellesley College and associate director of Russian studies at Harvard University, author of The Piratization of Russia. Good evening and welcome, Marshall Goldman. Good
Thanks,
to have you.
Thanks, Tom.
Wonderful to have you. We've heard just a bit from Serge and we'll hear more, but your first thoughts when you heard the news, the bulletin came across on Friday, Paul Klebnikov, editor of Forbes in Russia, shot dead on the streets of Moscow.
Oh, my God, that was my reaction. It was part because, indeed, as Serge said, this was a taboo, but I looked at it from a purely personal point of view. As you mentioned, I wrote this book called The Piratization of Russia, and it really it looks at the oligarchs. And so what I said to myself, there but for Paul Klebnikov, go I, and I, since I go to Russia, I really worry about it personally. It's not just that it was a journalist that was shot or an American that was shot. It is indeed a blow against, I think, anybody who dares to stand up or say anything that those in power or those who out of power who want power would be upset by. And so it for me, it was a question of lawlessness and really a very sad commentary on how far Russia has not been able to go.
Marshall, talk to us about the work that Paul Klebnikov did, most famously, very recently, with an early edition of the new Forbes presence there in Russia. This list, the 100 wealthiest Russians, we've all seen this in Forbes in the United States. It's done in many countries and continents around the world. But in Russia, very upsetting.
It was very upsetting because particularly initially, of course, it looked like a good idea. Back in the mid-90s, Forbes, the American journal, published a list. It was done by Paul Klebnikov then, too, for the American edition. And indeed, one of the members of the list, Boris Berezovsky, was very proud of the fact that they called seven oligarchs. They basically, he said, controlled half of the Russian economy. But now what they've discovered, particularly after the arrest of Khodorkovsky, is that too much transparency means that they know who to hone in on, that the government knows who to hone in on. I should say, by the way, that in China, when Forbes published a similar list, the Chinese were equally unhappy because immediately some of the members on that list became arrested. So he published that list, but also he went out specifically after specific oligarchs, particularly Berezovsky. Mm. And there was a lawsuit of libel in London that basically Forbes had to back away from. It was kind of a no contest.
Right.
But Paul Klebnikov had a way of making enemies, and I think this is probably the saddest story.
Speaking truth, and in today's Russia, in that, making enemies. Serge Schmemann, Paul Klebnikov had written at length about Boris Berezovsky. He wrote the book Godfather of the Kremlin, Boris Berezovsky and the Looting of Russia. Boris Berezovsky has said in the days since Paul's murder, he said from his exile in London, Klebnikov wanted to show how Russian capitalism was built. He said, but money loves silence, especially in Russia. He condemned Paul's murder. But why so great a love for silence right now? Has the atmosphere, Serge, in Russia turned against the oligarchs? Marshall Goldman was just mentioning former head of Yukos Oil, who's now sitting in prison, who just today was in a cage before a court in Moscow. What's going on with Russian attitudes toward that great and often looted wealth?
Well, certainly the arrest of Khodorkovsky has shown that many Russians resent this tremendously. I think a great measure of Putin's popularity is that he is going after oligarchs. He's gone after Khodorkovsky. He's got after Lebedev, who worked with Khodorkovsky. Brzezinski's in exile. Gusinski's in exile. So there is a tremendous amount of satisfaction that the government is going after people who are perceived in Russia largely as thieves, as bandits. It's very important, however, to note that we really don't know why Paul was killed at this stage. We don't know by whom, for what reason. A lot of attention is focused on that list. He may have been doing investigative reporting about somebody else. I have to say I spoke at great length today with Paul's wife, Musa. She's in Italy right now. And she was enormously noble and wanted to stress that Paul would not have wanted to become a symbol of turning against Russia at this stage, of being, of sort of dismissing the place. And she said, you know, that he really believed that despite everything that's going on, that there was a chance, that Russia was pursuing a chance, and that much of the work he was doing, exposing these oligarchs, exposing the things that were going on, was based on an optimism, on a real faith that Russia was at a point in its history when it could be reformed. And one of her strong hopes was that this could be pursued, that this sort of investigative effort will not die. And it's also my hope that at this, in some way, this horror will galvanize people to demand more of the government, more protection, more battle with corruption, with this kind of attitude that murder can resolve all kinds of disputes and that you can achieve silence and intimidation through murder. So, you know, on her front, on Musa's front, she is battling to maintain his faith and his idealism.
Serge, we have to respect that, coming from a new widow who's taken this terrible blow and who must have spoken with Paul very, very often. And yet that goes almost directly in the face of the surge of anger and disappointment that you've expressed just today about Russia maybe doesn't even want to become a normal country.
That is indeed my fear. You know, you believe, you want to believe, you want to sense that something is happening, but as I said earlier, it will really require some evidence, not only of a government that's willing to do something about it, but of people who want something resolved. They don't just want vengeance against either oligarchs or against Westerners who seem to be mucking around. That people will really demand a rule of law. And I have to say that I personally, and my anger is that I just haven't sensed that great national clamor, hunger for freedom. There are so many people who support Putin when he clamps down on the press, when he clamps down on the oligarchs. You know, Berezovsky, whose name was mentioned, he did what somebody has the right to do. He went to the courts in London, and he fought against this article. He fought to clear his name. So there are avenues. There are avenues in Russia as well. Now, again, we don't know why this happened. A lot of attention is on that list because that list did sort of establish the hierarchy of the oligarchs. And that's why we all focus on that. Again, we don't know exactly what it was. Khodorkovsky himself in prison expressed remorse. Brzezinski expressed remorse at this stage. I am listening very hard to hear remorse from Putin. I have not heard it yet from the president.
Not hearing that remorse yet. But oligarchs, the kind of people that Paul Klebnikov wrote about expressing their own remorse. Marshall Goldman, last fall, when Khodorkovsky, the head of Yukos, the richest man in Russia, was thrown in jail by Vladimir Putin, Paul Klebnikov wrote in the Wall Street Journal, and he, in a sense, in a way, came to the defense of Putin. And he said that, look, he got this huge oil company for pennies on the dollar. He paid essentially $300 million for it, and it's now worth $24 billion. This was a ripoff. This is a righting of the scales. Things are headed in a decent direction here. He said, and I quote, "We are witnessing the final death agony of the kleptocracy that was Boris Yeltsin's Russia." So what's going on, Marshall? Was Paul Klebnikov wrong last fall with that optimism? He's dead today, and Serge is correct. We don't know exactly why, but it would appear entirely possible that it's as a result of him challenging that some remnant of that kleptocracy.
It's so complicated. First of all, I would agree with Klebnikov when he said at the time that Kharkovsky is guilty of many of the charges that are levied against him, maybe all the charges. But, you know, why did they pick on Kharkovsky? Because it turns out that there are other oligarchs, including Abramovich, the man who controls another oil company. Sibneff is the man who bought the Chelsea football, you know, soccer team.
And worth a mere $12 billion, Abramovich.
And he's paid even less in the way of taxes. Mm. But he's has friends inside the Kremlin, and so they didn't pick on him. They picked on Kharkovsky.
Mm-hmm.
So, and in fact, they could have picked almost everybody on that list. So, I don't see this as indeed the beginning of a new situation. I think it's still arbitrary. There are other reasons for going after Kharkovsky. He challenged Putin politically. He began to talk about building his own pipelines, breaking up with a monopoly. He tried to have lobbies in the Duma, in the parliament, to prevent tax increases. Mm-hmm. So there's just a whole series of things that went after him. I'm much more skeptical and cynical about this kind of thing. Look, I mean, I agree with Serge that it would be nice if there were revulsion at what took place and there was a mobilization of public opinion. But we should understand that while Klebnikov was an American, there have been Russians, a whole series of Russians in the Duma. It would be like assassinating members of Congress.
Yes.
And that has not aroused much in the way of public indignation.
Let alone an American, even if a returning Russian
American.
That's
right. So I kind of view this as the result of a failed reform effort. I mean, I've been very cynical about what took place. And people who called it a normal economy, I think, are just way off base here.
We're talking tonight about a death in Moscow and its meaning. You can join the conversation at 1-800-423-8255. Andrea's on the line. Hi, Andrea. You're on the air.
Hello. I spent a year in the Eastern Bloc back in the 70s. And one of the things that people asked me over and over again while I was there was, aren't you afraid to live in America? Aren't you afraid of the gangsters? And I find myself hearing stories about the situation currently in Russia, wondering if there isn't some sort of cultural expectation that this is what the West is like and that's just part of the whole modernization and Westernization.
You see this violence as modeling on the West? Do you really mean that?
I don't, but for example, one of the few things they showed on TV was The Untouchables in very poor translation, and I talked to people who thought that was current-day America. And
I'd say, Andrew, you're not too far off, because indeed the way they were dressing, the way the mafia members, the pure mafia members were dressing,
was really
patterned on The Godfather. They watched the movie. They cut their hair that way. They wore the clothing that way. And so to some extent, there is this, you know, they look to see this is the way mafia members should behave.
But if they're patterning, if they're modeling on the United States or on the West, why The Godfather? Why movies? Why gangsters from the 30s? Why not a more civil, transparent, and ultimately, presumably, effective kind of capitalism?
Well, this is not the oligarchs. I mean, what she's referring to and what I'm referring to, I think, at least in her case, that these are
the real criminal
element. Criminals. I mean, you know, that sometimes it's hard to tell one from another, or even from a KGB, Nick. But in this case, these were guys who really were mobs, and you could identify themselves as mobsters.
Serge Smaman, what do you make of the broad streak of violence that we still see in Russia today, in the kind of gangster culture that we're just talking about, in the culture that guns down members of the Duma? What's going on here? Why? When does Russia get free of it?
Yeah, well, there is a superficial similarity to the mafia in America, but the difference is that the people who really run the country are all from the same source, and there is a real competition for power, for wealth, and it's a very violent competition. And, some of the oligarchs rose to a level where they tried to regularize their situation, they tried to legalize their money. It became convenient for them to be legal and to appear transparent. But the fact is that at the core, there really is no rule of law. If somebody is arrested, if there is enough money paid for silence, there will be silence. You know, the police are still enormously low-paid and corrupt. We really don't know, you know, how the Secret Services, to whom they are truly loyal, there is every evidence that they also want a piece of the action, a piece of the power and money. So it's a scramble at the very top. The mafia was trying to act underground in America to challenge the law that did exist. There was a system of law that could be eventually restored and was over them. But in Russia, it's a total mix where the law is used by others, by the state, by agencies, in fact, by some of the oligarchs themselves. One of the gimmicks among oligarchs is to go to a court and to get a ruling against some factory they want to take over and then to forcibly take it over. So that total absence of a strong rule of law is the factor that really makes this possible. And I think Paul's faith in Putin, many people's faith in Vladimir Putin, was based on the fact that he was trying to restore order, that he was trying to impose some kind of control over this chaos. But also, Paul, in his last interview, taken 7 hours before he was killed with his vestia, expressed the fear that there is really a transfer going on, a transfer from this collection of people who grew wildly wealthy and powerful in the 90s to the government, and that the government is being equally brutal in its methods in just simply trying to grab the power away from them, but not to create an atmosphere of normalcy. And I think one of the great signs of that is that small and middle businesses have simply failed to take hold. Once you have enough power and money, you can protect yourself. Not always, as Hodorkovsky showed, but at least you have a fighting chance. But at the lower level, where you want to start a business, where you want to get rolling, it still remains enormously difficult, if not impossible.
Marshall Goldman, just a minute before the break, but what about Vladimir Putin's effect? He sits down at the G8 and these other international meetings. He's treated like one of the crowd, like he represents a normal nation. In what direction do you see Putin having taken Russia so far?
I see it taking in the wrong direction. I mean, I would agree with Serge that he tried to indeed restore a certain amount of order, but in doing that, to restore that order, he had to bring in a lot of his former comrades from the KGB, what they call the Siloviki, the kind of law and order people. And they indeed have gone to the other extreme. And we've been talking about the economic side, but if you talk about the political side, you know, Putin has basically suppressed all the independent television coverage, so that the state now controls all the television media. One of the things that Serge wrote about this morning was that what we think will be the cancellation of one of the last programs, Freedom of the Press.
With Savak Schuster.
Yeah, that's right. So that you know, and Putin calls it the dictatorship of the law, which I think reflects his KGB background. So, politically, I think it's just the wrong way. Now, that I don't deny that he's done some good things, but in the process, I think he's overdone it.
We'll come back and look at Vladimir Putin and look at the press in Russia and the circumstances it's operating under. We're talking tonight about a death in Moscow, the murder of American journalist Paul Klebnikov, and the lethal intersection of business, politics, and crime in Putin's Russia. Where do you imagine responsibility for this death lies? With corrupt criminal business, with corrupt criminal government, or both? And does Putin's Russia deserve its American embrace? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. We're talking tonight about a death in Moscow, the murder last Friday of American journalist, editor-in-chief of Forbes Russia, Paul Klebnikov, a Russian-American gunned down in the streets of Moscow, four bullets, and a dead journalist who had tried hard to bring truth and light to the world of Russian business and Russian power. You can join the conversation tonight. What do you think? Does Vladimir Putin belong at the table of the G8? Is Moscow getting a pass from Washington because of its support in the war on terror? Should it get that pass? And can truth and openness, like Paul Klebnikov's, ultimately prevail in Russia? Do Russians want it enough to get it? We're at 1-800-423-8255. That's 1-800-423-TALK. I'm joined tonight from Paris by Serge Schmaman, former Moscow bureau chief of the New York Times, now editorial page editor at the International Herald Tribune. With me in the studio, Marshall Goldman, professor emeritus of Russian economics at Wellesley College and author of The Piratization of Russia. And right now from New York by Alex Lupus, he is Europe and Central Asia program coordinator for the Committee to Protect Journalists. Good evening and welcome, Alex Lupus.
Thanks very much.
It's great having you. Alex, a lot of journalists dead since the year 2000, since Vladimir Putin came to power. What's going on? Is it a death-defying act to be a real working journalist in Moscow today?
It is. It's an incredibly risky business, and we've actually seen, since Putin came to power, a steady decline of press freedom and growing restrictions that are being implemented by numerous different government institutions. We see a continuity of impunity that throughout the 90s and into this decade, dozens of journalists have been murdered in retaliation for their work. But I should say that that's actually just a small part of the picture. There have been a tremendous number of abuses committed against journalists throughout Russia's regions by the police, by soldiers and security services. Also, prosecutors and courts continue to implement outdated laws like criminal defamation laws, which can be used to imprison journalists. Then you have other government institutions like the Central Election Commission and the Media Ministry, which have all kinds of restrictions and penalties. And of course, there's been Putin's effort and certainly the Kremlin's effort to reassert its control over all national television channels that broadcast news. So this really, I would say that the impunity for murder and the continuity of that is I think just part of a broader policy of the Kremlin to reassert its control over any independent voices in the country.
And as Serge Maimon and Marshall Goldman point out, on the same day that Paul Klebnikov was murdered, it was the last day of what Serge calls the last decent political program in Russia, NTV's Freedom of Speech, in English translation, at a station that Mr. Putin is forcibly bringing under state control. How do you assess the state of the media over it all then, Alex Lupus? With all these threats, the deaths, the intimidation of journalists, does Russia have any free press at this point?
I think you have to characterize it in different gradations. I mean, the Kremlin is obviously the most concerned about national television coverage, news and current events programs on the national channels, because those have the most influence. Russia was a very literate society and read a lot under communism, but with the fall of salaries and fall in subsidies for newspapers, the readership has really declined quite a bit. So I think because of those differences, there is a bit more freedom in newspapers to criticize the government or government officials within certain bounds. And beyond that, in even a narrower audience on the internet, you see a little bit more freedom to do so. But regardless, I think in on all levels, you've seen a steady deterioration. And again, it's we see it as multiple government institutions which have been encouraging these restrictions in different ways. In some cases, through violent abuses against journalists, particularly those trying to cover the war in Chechnya. But I think on a more subtle level, day-to-day abuses against journalists that the police and courts are committing throughout Russia's many regions. And even in more subtle ways, I think Gazprom, the state gas company, which took over NTV, the largest independent television channel. I mean, those are just all signs of how they're trying to reassert their control.
So still courage at a lower level, Russian journalists trying to do the right thing. What is it then? What's the pattern, Alex, that tips the response over into violence and even murder, even death? You mentioned coverage of Chechnya. Is that the no-go zone? Is it coverage of big business interests? What tends to bring, a deadly response from whatever powers?
Well, I think the three issues which we consistently see journalists being attacked for are writing about government corruption, about organized crime, and about human rights abuses. And I think clearly those are sensitive issues because when those three types of issues are exposed, people could go to jail. Chechnya, obviously, in terms of human rights, there are Russian police and military officials and possibly even civilian officials in the Kremlin who could be accused of war crimes, and certainly they have an interest in hiding that. Also, Russia's secretive government does not have a lot of open information about budgets and financial issues and how money is transferred and used. So there are a lot of tend to be abuses there that government officials don't want looked into. And of course, organized crime, the links between the organized crime and the police, the organized crime and political officials is very sensitive. I think looking at this in a broader level, we need to understand that under communism, the media was seen as a political tool. It wasn't seen as something to promote accountability. It wasn't seen as something dedicated to informing citizens. It was seen as something used to shape public opinion. And given that Vladimir Putin is a career KGB man, at least until the late 80s, he was formed by that system. And the vast majority of Russian bureaucrats and politicians are a product of the Soviet system. It's in many ways a natural inclination for them to try to suppress independent news because of that history.
Alex Lupus, Marshall Goldman, Serge Freeman, stand by. I want to bring our callers in. A lot of them are waiting. Julia is on the line. Hi, Julia. You're on the air.
Hello.
Hi.
When I heard the news about the killing, it just my hair just went up, and it's outrageous. I came from Russia 14 years ago, and I lived here all these years trying to see what's going on in Russia, but it's obvious that nothing can change, even in 15 years. What democracy are we talking about? Same people who were at the power 14 years ago when the communists were there are around the power right now, and they just call themselves different titles. You can buy and sell anything in Russia. You can buy power. You can buy almost everything.
So, Julia, where does hope lie? Where can we find hope in Russia's future?
It's very hard. Hope. Hope. I think it has to be a lot of generations before you can even see the light at the end of the tunnel, and it's not the light of the incoming train. Even 100 years is not enough. The mentality of a person cannot change in 10 years or 15 years or 20 years. It's the whole generation. And one generation grows up to be angry because they don't have money and most of them are poor. Their concerns are, basic needs. They are poor and they're jealous of us in America, even though they're trying to copy almost everything, but they're jealous because we have everything and they have nothing. Most of the population is poor.
Except for those that have a lot. Julia, let us pick it up, and thank you so much for your call. Marshall Goldman, what about it? Serge Freeman raised it earlier, this notion that Russia may be just culturally incapable or unready to embrace the opportunities that we Americans like to think now sit in front of them. Is that too nihilistic?
Well, I don't think so. I mean, let me just give you an illustration of how serious the problem is. You know, we've been talking about how unfortunate it is that the journalists have been singled out for killing and assassination. But we should also remember that the journalists in some cases are equally culpable because recently one investigative reporter published a price list of what it would cost to have an article in the newspaper attacking one of your enemies.
In other words, you can buy the press.
I could say the same thing about academics. There's just been an article that appeared this week whereby there was a price list of how much it would cost to be admitted to the university because you could buy your way through the people interviewing you for the job. So it's pervasive. The corruption is so overwhelming. And as Julia said, it's nothing new. In many ways, it's continuity from what existed before.
So what position then, Serge Freeman, let me put this to you, should the United States take? If it's going to take, I don't know, decades for Russia to come around to something like normalcy, or perhaps, worse thought, if it never will, then how should Washington interact with Moscow?
Well, we have to presume that it is possible and that someday it can happen. But I think that at this point, and I think that's one of the feelings I had when I wrote that article, is that Putin is definitely on probation. We have all given him every benefit of every doubt. I think so many people have wanted to see that things are moving in the right direction. But I think, as Alex correctly points out, Putin, from his old habits, still sees the press as an enemy, as something competing for his power, the way he saw Khodorkovsky. Mm-hmm. Marshall was right. He did not go after Khodorkovsky because he got a lot of money. He went after him because he was becoming a threat to his power. And so when you see business as a threat, when you see the press as a threat, it really is true that the basic instincts have not changed, as Julia pointed out. So I think Khodorkovsky definitely is now on probation. I think
Putin, that is.
For many, many people today expressing that sense. You know, he should not sit on the G8 until he shows that he understands what it means to sit on the G8. And the signs are that he doesn't get it. And I think at this stage, it should be a far tougher attitude. It's time for him, for Russia, to start proving itself, that it does understand what business is, what law is, what press is, what freedom is, that there is some sign of change. And I think it's important to start putting serious pressure on that government to behave in the way that it wants to be treated.
And yet we don't see that at the moment. Let me get one more call here. Carl's calling from Portland, Maine. Hi, Carl. You're on the air.
Hey, good evening. Yeah, mm-hmm. I was of course, horrified. I actually had gone to high school with Paul Klebnikov. But, you know, the judgment on Russia of not having a legitimate or a functioning fourth estate, absolutely true, and it's obviously exposed as such. But before we get too proud as Americans, I think we really need to ask how well is our own fourth estate functioning, given the debacle of what's happened in the last couple of years. So before we get so prideful about how terrible they are and how their media does not work, at least it's exposed. The terrible thing in America is that many people still believe that true investigative journalism can be found on, the Fox News channel.
And you're saying let's not throw stones too joyously here. Carl, how do you remember Paul Klebnikov in high school?
Well, I was 2 years ahead of him, and I remember him working on the newspaper as being a very aggressive, and it was his life's work, and he knew it from the age of about 15.
And so it was, and he did it with tremendous flair and impact until a sad end. Carl, we take your point, and we thank you for calling in with it. Sir Schmaman, we just have a couple minutes left here. Leave us with some memories of Paul Klebnikov. We don't want to get so lost in policy that we forget the man who died last Friday. Talk to us about him.
Paul was a really optimistic guy, I guess. In my story, I said he was almost naively optimistic. This is a guy who just wanted to see things in a good light. I mean, his investigative reporting was not based on a muckraking instinct, but on an instinct that things can be improved. There was a great optimism there. He was also very, very conscious and very proud of being Russian. He sang Russian songs to his children. He has three small children. He took them to Russian Orthodox churches. He wanted them to be proud of Russia. And in the last weeks, he had been trying very hard to persuade his wife to move to Russia. She had continued living in New York where the children can go to school. So it was very important to him. It was a very important part of his whole attitude towards life that here was a country from which his ancestors came and which he could help. And this was really based on a very kind of glowing faith in Russia, in the future. He was a very, very friendly, cheery guy. I have never seen him in a bad mood.
We're sorry that all that was not ultimately returned. But Serge Schmaman, thank you so much for joining us at such a late hour from Paris tonight. Our gratitude to you.
Thank you very much.
Serge Schmaman, editorial page editor of the International Herald Tribune, and Alex Lupus in New York with the Committee to Protect Journalists. Thank you so much for coming on tonight.
Thank you.
And Marshall Goldman with me in the studio, author of The Piratization of Russia, Russian Reform Goes Awry. Wonderful as always to have you. Thanks for being here.
Thank you.
Listeners, you can read a biography of Paul Klebnikov on our website. Go to onpointradio.org. I'm Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.